Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When any two people get married, there's a process of forming a family culture, which includes everything from developing inside jokes to divvying up household chores. Even if you are perfectly aligned on the things that truly matter in your relationship, the process inevitably reveals some differences between people who are deeply in love. Consider how much those revelations might be magnified if you and your partner came not simply from different families, but from different countries. Tracy Slater can tell us what that's like. She and her now husband, Toru, fell deeply, almost instantly in love when Slater moved temporarily to Japan to coach business executives on their English. He was her student. He spoke broken English at the time. She didn't speak a word of Japanese, and neither was necessarily eager to embrace the other's culture. But this first ever truly right relationship convinced Slater it was worth trying, and the effort taught her more about herself than she could have imagined. Tracy Slater is founder of the global literary series Four Stories and author of the new memoir, The Good Shufu, Finding Love, Self, and Home on the Far Side of the World. Tracy, welcome to Think.
So good to be with you, Chris. Thanks.
Okay, take us back to May of 2004. What possessed you to take a job in Kobe, Japan for the summer?
Well, I was teaching writing in an MBA program in Boston, and the university had the idea that because I taught American business people, I could go to Asia to work in their Asian executive MBA program, and that somehow my teaching would enable these Asian executives to learn to communicate like native English speakers. And because I had never taught ESL before, I didn't realize what a flawed idea this was. So that's why I originally went over for that and also the business class tickets that they offered.
Yeah, you thought, well, I'll get some traveling in while I'm doing this thing and it'll just be a kind of a lark, right?
Exactly, exactly. Although my mother did say before I left, whatever you do, don't fall in love over there. And of course, I laughed as if that was the silliest idea ever.
As part of your preparations, you read up on the typical pattern of expatriate reactions to living in foreign places. And they go, and I love the Kubler-Rossness of this whole thing, honeymoon, disintegration, reintegration, autonomy, acceptance.
Yeah, those are the sort of traditional stages of culture shock. So either for expats or even just travelers. And of course, I assumed that I would only be a traveler and a short-term traveler.
But you did, of course, ultimately stay much longer, and we'll talk about that in a minute. One of the things you had loved before this, though, before you took this trip, was your independence. You had this life where nobody could tell you what to do. You were not in the market for a long-term relationship. You laughed at your mother's warning because you thought it'll never happen.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that I was completely opposed to a long-term relationship, but I was very opposed to any kind of life that would require me to give up what felt like my very fierce independence.
You were drawn to Toru, who is now your husband, from the very beginning. Can you talk about the first spark and what made him so fascinating to you?
Yeah, I think the first time I saw him, I just really liked the way he looked, to be very shallow. But, you know, the first couple of days in the classroom, I was actually working as a conversation coach, so I wasn't sort of really a regular faculty member, and I was observing them in the classroom. And he just had a real quiet about him and a real sense of calm. He moved in a kind of unhurried way. He was very thoughtful. And even though I could barely communicate with him, there was something of that calm essence that really came through to me just from watching him and from the way that he moved. And he was so different from anyone that I had ever really known. And I was really drawn to that.
I want to be clear that he did speak English, not perfectly, but you didn't speak a word of Japanese. I've always been curious about relationships that form among people who aren't initially able to communicate everything to one another, and especially for someone like you, for whom language is clearly very important.
Yeah, language. I had, before I took a job teaching writing, I also taught literature at the university level as well, and I had earned a PhD in English and American literature, and language and reading was always such a huge part of my life. I never envisioned I would, as you said, marry a man or be with a partner who wasn't not just fluent. I mean, he could read quite well, but he really could only communicate in very broken conversational English. But I have to say that after, you know, not too long into our relationship, after a couple of weeks into our relationship, I realized there are some real benefits to having limits on the ability to communicate in a relationship, particularly a new one.
What are those benefits?
Well, I guess I had always been, and I still am, I have to be honest, you could say a little overly analytical at times. I sort of like to analyze everything. And one place that I used to always get into trouble in my past relationships was that I love to analyze them right from the start. So whenever I was in a relationship with a man who inevitably couldn't fully understand me, because two human beings never fully understand each other. And I knew that intellectually, but the sort of analytical and worrywart part of me would always take that as some enormous sign or signal of future incompatibility, and that there was some deep flaw in the relationship, and that somehow this person wasn't understanding me, not just what I was saying, but in some kind of profound, existential way. And it would always be an issue for me. And with Toru, I was sort of like, well, the guy doesn't speak English, you know, give him a break. So it really took a lot of pressure off.
What's interesting about that is I speak a little bit of Spanish, not very good Spanish at all, and I speak a lot in the present tense. And I wonder if, like, having to speak in the present tense or having limited ability keeps you living in the present.
That's such an interesting point. I never thought about that. I think maybe what I did think about, and what I can say without having thought through it fully, is that there's a way in which the sort of simplicity of a connection between people, or at least between me and Toru, the sort of simple stuff really came through. And what he said and what he said about how he felt, I was sort of able to take at face value. And that goes back to my earlier point about it kind of put a little bit of a stop on my tendency to overanalyze everything.
Ordinarily, when people come together and they find themselves really attracted to one another, they go through and find all the ways in which they are similar. And you had few of these. Not least was the fact that your families were really different from one another. Like, theoretically, it would have been possible across cultures to have grown up in similar family situations. But in fact, you'd had a lot of material advantages, but also this kind of weird burden of having your mother's favoritism. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. You're so right that we weren't just culturally different in terms of, you know, the countries that we grew up in and the cultures that we grew up in, but the families that we grew up in were so culturally different. And I think that's really a true challenge for a lot of people, even if they end up with someone who grows up in the same country. And for me, you know, Tor's family was much and is much less sort of materially oriented than my family. And I had always assumed that I was somebody who kind of needed a high level of material comfort and support in order to sort of cope. And I just really learned to appreciate and respect Toro's family's values. You know, they valued their home because it was the place that they lived and not because it was a place necessary to decorate nicely. And not just in terms of his family, but also his culture. You know, Japan is such a place where humility is prized. And in America, we don't grow up to prize humility necessarily. We grow up to prize confidence and individuality. And so the combination of Japanese culture, I think, and also the fact that his family really at heart really are quite humble people, just really there was a kind of integrity there that I realized, you know, it's sort of, there are downsides to not necessarily knowing that you will always be able to have someone who might be able to come in once a week and clean your house. But there are also really, you know, wonderful things about living a little bit more of a simple life where you're focused on other things besides material goods and material competition.
One of the early arguments you had when you set up house together was like how often you would eat out. And you thought, why would I cook if I can order food somewhere? And he thought it was just insane that you would eat out every night.
Yes. He said that. He said, just not normal. So, and you know, I cook now. I can't say I cook well, but I do cook.
And you discovered, first of all, tell us what a weekly mansion is, because it's maybe not as awesome as it sounds.
Yeah. It's so Japanese to me that that the term is weekly mansion. It's actually weekly. That's what it is. They use the English term. It means a short-term rental, basically. So an apartment that you rent without a kind of year-long contract or something. And they're frequently used by business people for a couple of weeks or a couple of months who are on a short-term assignment. But they're tiny, tiny. And it's just so – Japan is such a world of contradictions, these sort of wonderful, funny, surprising contradictions. And this is just a small kind of reflection of that, that they – I don't know why they call them weekly mansions, but when I first started going to Japan, Toru was living with his father, which is quite common for people to live with their parents until they marry in Japan. And so when I would come, we would rent this little weekly mansion, and it was, you know, maybe I think it was 250 square feet or something. I mean, it was tiny, tiny. It had like a tiny little bed and a tiny little hot pot. But that's what it's called. It's called the weekly mansion.
So the job itself that you initially took was in some ways like a crash course in Japanese culture, including the fact that you were violating this gigantic norm by coming in without knowing much about Japanese culture.
Yeah, and I had students who were from Japan and students who were from South Korea. And in both of those cultures, it's a real faux pas to try to do business or do something educational or do something sort of meaningful without having a sense of somebody else's culture. And that's actually something that I hadn't really thought about before, being an American growing up in the U.S. and not being exposed to that many other cultures. That's actually another example of something that I've come to appreciate. It makes sense to me that before you really work with somebody that you develop some kind of knowledge and, if possible, appreciation of their culture.
How were women instructors treated as compared with male instructors?
Women instructors, well, I was a young woman compared to most of the students in my program. And as you said, a young woman who didn't know very much about cultural norms at all in Japan or in East Asia, basically. And I was, you know, as an American university, someone who taught at a university, I was always taught to project confidence and competence and a sense of invulnerability. And in Japan and in East Asian corporate culture, East Asian educational culture, that was seen as somewhat of an insult, not just being a woman, but being a younger woman, was told that I should speak more quietly and I should act a little bit more humbly. And I really alienated a lot of my students, particularly the senior executive students, senior meaning older students, because I wasn't behaving the way that they expected a woman, and particularly a young woman, to behave.
We're speaking this hour with Tracy Slater. She is founder of the global literary series Four Stories and author of the new memoir, The Good Shufu, Finding Love, Self, and Home on the Far Side of the World. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to be part of it, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Tracy Slater about her new memoir, The Good Shufu, Finding Love, Self, and Home on the Far Side of the World. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, as we speak, Tracy, I'm in a studio in Dallas. You're in a studio in Boston. And this is not just the place where you grew up. This amounts to your, like, ancestral home.
Yes, it's where I always planned to settle and thought I would never move from, not even to another part of the U.S.
Hmm. I've never had that, like a place where all my family was and, you know, my grandparents grew up all in the same location. But it means more to you than someone maybe who bounced around as a kid and really didn't have a home place.
Yes. Yeah. There was some way in which my identity and my sense of safety and place in the world became tied to Boston, partly because, well, one, because it's a city that I love, but also partly because it's a city, the city I had almost always lived in. I had short stints in other places, like a couple of months, but it's where I just always envisioned being.
So after the summer course that you taught, Toru was scheduled to study in Boston for 9 months, and I guess you thought he will see this place, he will fall in love with it, and then we can live here forever.
Yeah, I thought I was going to be able to fit him into my nice little life plan.
And what happened?
And guess how that worked out. he was open to the concept of living in the U.S., so I wasn't initially completely fooling myself. But he is the oldest son. It's called the Chonan in Japanese culture. And the Chonan in Japan inherits the responsibility to care for his parents. As they age, or if they're widowed or ill or in need. And his mother, Toru's mother, was killed in an awful accident quite soon after we met. And it became clear quite quickly into our relationship that Toru, I knew from just a couple of weeks with Toru that he was a man who would never, ever shirk his sense of duty. And it became quite clear when his mother died that he would go back to Japan indefinitely to care for his father, who was widowed and soon became ailing after his wife died.
So when you realized that you would have to return to Japan if you wanted to make this relationship work, I love this. You had two simultaneous thoughts, and I don't know if you remember the passage I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yes, I do. I thought, there is no way that I can do this, and there is no way that I can possibly not try. I didn't say it quite in that way, but...
So what do you do with those conflicting emotions?
I guess I just sort of shut my eyes and leapt. Some people say they take a leap of faith with a kind of sense of exhilaration with their, you know, eyes wide open. And for me, it was eyes completely sealed shut. I was never, ever someone who not only did I ever think I would take a leap of faith, but I had a bit of a snarky attitude towards people who even thought leaps of faith were a good idea. But I just knew that if I didn't try this, I would regret it forever. And I also realized, you know, one part of sort of being an adult and living in the real world is that sometimes you really do have to accept two conflicting things at one time and sort of figure out how to muddle through it. Not gracefully, maybe. And I can't say that I made the transition totally gracefully. I was still, and still am, you know, pretty neurotic throughout the whole thing. But somehow I muddled through it and have found a greater sense of self and roots and home than I really think I would have had my initial plan and my sort of whole life and worldview gone my way.
And so you do this thing and you are simultaneously like really excited because you found love and that's not something that happens every day. And yet you think to yourself, like, I can't believe I moved for a guy. Like, I've given up this thing that I expected to build of my career and the potential for working in quite the ways I expected is uncertain now. How did you convince yourself to keep going on in the moments where you thought, what's happening to my career? What's happening to my career? Why am I here?
I guess I, again, not always gracefully. Sometimes I just kept going because it was the only thing that I could see to do. Mm-hmm. And to be totally honest, I still struggle with the truth of the fact that I gave up so much of my plan and my life and my world and my expected career for a man. It's still so opposed to how I see myself and my identity. And yet I know that Toru was totally worth it. And I have a much greater rootedness within myself for having done it. But I also think on a more pragmatic level, the way that I dealt with it was, you know, I went through, oh, I don't know, at least a couple of years of really tormenting myself over just what you said, these sort of uncertainties about where would my career have been, what would I be doing, and all of these sort of fantasies about how wonderful, you know, my life and my career and my hair would be, were I still living in the U.S. full time. And I realized that it could all be true, but that's not the choice I've made. And it's just not productive for me to be sort of bashing myself over the head over what I could have done or whether the grass would have been greener on the side that I had, you know, that I had now left. And so I realized what I really needed to do was just take the life that I had and make it the best life that I could and make it fit as much as possible my goals and sort of my dreams and my desires.
People might assume that from the moment you arrived in Japan for the first time that you were studying the language. But in fact, it was a big step for you to decide, okay, I really need to learn Japanese.
It was a big step. And that's such an interesting point. I didn't realize sort of how interesting that concept would be or how difficult it would be for some people to accept. That's probably the greatest thing that irks people. Not that I know, but sort of comments that I've gotten about on my blog or on Amazon or on different things that I've written about being in a bilingual relationship is how could you possibly be in a relationship with someone who's not fluent in your language and how could you not possibly have immediately rectified that situation? And as I said before, there are actually things I like about being in a relationship where you're not 100% fluent in either language. But also it was very symbolic to me when I first realized I was going to build a life with Toru and that life was going to be in Japan. It was very symbolic to me that I was giving up so much of myself and, as I said, my life and my plans. And, you know, language is something that I just love. And it's a huge part of my career, a huge part of what I think makes me feel a sense of wonder in the world, the way people use language and create art out of it. And I thought, you know what, I don't want to give up my life in English, and I don't want to speak Japanese in the home, and I don't want to learn Japanese right away. I was willing to kind of live in an expat bubble and maintain English as not only my prime language, but pretty much the only language that I functioned in.
Do you think there was something to that decision or holding off on the decision to study Japanese that had to do with power within the relationship?
Yeah, that's such an interesting point. I do think that. I always in the past have thought about it as kind of holding on to just a little piece of my life when I felt like I had given up so much. But I think at base what that really is just what you said, a sort of desire to maintain some sense of power, not only over sort of the world and reality, what have I given up, but to, you know, to say, I'm moving to your world maybe, but I'm still going to sort of maintain my own hold on my language.
And in your defense, I mean, there was a lot for you to become accustomed to. There are stories of, you know, men and women of sort of equal rank, and the men are called Mr. and the women are called by their first names. And there's a story where you went to have a lovely dinner with Toru's aunt and uncle. And at the end of it, something that to your eyes was really shocking happened.
Yeah. And that was, it's a moment that I describe in the book. And it's also a moment that I think about a lot as one of the big learning moments for me, not just about Japan, but about my life and the world. What happened was Toru's aunt and uncle held a dinner for me to welcome me to their family. Toru and I weren't married yet, but it was clear that we were, you know, headed in that direction, and to welcome me to Japan. And at the end of the dinner, his aunt and uncle walked us to the door, and his aunt sort of looked to me initially like she was falling to the ground. And I thought she had dropped a contact lens or stubbed her toe or something. I didn't know. So I started sort of, heading down towards the floor, basically, to help her. And Toru nudged me and immediately whispered, to get up. What are you doing? And I realized, and this was all in over a couple of split seconds. And then she sort of rose. And I realized, good Lord, this woman's bowing to me. I'd never seen anyone bow and touch their forehead to the floor. And as she started to come up, I thought, this woman's bowing in her own home. And that must be such a humiliation in a way that she's expected to do that. And yet as she sort of righted up fully, I saw on her face this expression of real sort of pride in her culture and in her ability to welcome me so beautifully to her home and to sort of follow protocol so well. And I realized, everything that I, or so many of the value judgments that I place on the world and the ways in which I understand the world in terms of gender and family and just personal agency and a personal sense of respect, all those things, none of them really map to Japan anymore. And there was something very freeing to me about realizing that.
Have you over time picked up that habit of the little sort of dip of the head that connotes respect?
I do. And I have to tell you, it's a real double-edged sword because it's automatic for me now. So I do it in America all the time when I'm back and I just know I look like a total dork. I'm just, bowing to people. And obviously I don't look Japanese, so
I think it's sort of charming, but I can understand if you don't look Japanese that people are wondering where it came from.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, it's sort of automatic to me now.
Talk about how you deliberately sought out friendships with other expatriates and the role that they played in their lives. Because interestingly, it wasn't like you just found Americans. You found people coming from anywhere else into Japan.
Yes. Although I did really prioritize people whose native language was English. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know if statistically this is what the statistics are, but it definitely seemed that the English speaking expat community, particularly in Osaka, we now live in Tokyo. We just moved, but we were in Osaka for 10 years and for the period of time the book takes place. And the expat community there is not mainly American at all. It's definitely, British and people from Australia and people from Canada. And then there's a lot of people. It's actually mostly other Asians, people from Southeast Asia and other parts of East Asia. But for those people, English is not usually their first language. So they're not people that I sought out. And, again, that probably sounds terrible to people, but I really wanted to have an English-speaking social community.
And so what sorts of things did you discuss with your English-speaking friends?
Well, a lot of times we would discuss our sort of own fantasies of how what you and I, Chris, talked about a little bit earlier, of how our lives would still be were we back in our country. And it's certainly fun to kind of complain mm-hmm. about the culture that you're in now. Truthfully, though, most of the people that I have met in Japan have come to Japan for other reasons, not for a partner. So many of the people that I have become friendly with are people who actually do feel some sense of connection to Japan sort of individually and not, which is not like me. I feel fascinated by Japan and I love many aspects of Japan, but were it not for Toru, I would definitely not be in Japan.
So it's my personal feeling that a sense of humor is really important in a long-term relationship. A sense of humor is also hard when there's any kind of a language gap. And I wonder about the kinds of things that you and Toru laugh about together and if there are still things that, even after all these years, you both have to work a little extra hard to communicate.
I have to say, his sense of humor, I don't know how to explain it, but we have a really, really similar sense of humor. Hmm. And sometimes frequently he'll say something that I think is funny and he'll say it in different syntax than I would use or slightly skewed English. And for me, that only makes it funnier. Mm-hmm. So in that way, I feel we're really, really compatible and really, really lucky that for some reason, his humor is just really, really similar to mine. And he makes me laugh a lot of the time, which I think, as you said, is really important. And for me, is really, really crucial.
Was his family and were his friends always completely on board with the idea of him marrying this, probably to their mind, very outspoken, independent American woman?
I think you mean mouthy. Yes, actually, his family was just lovely to me, has always been, continues to be very, very welcoming. I mean, he lives a very traditional Japanese life in that he's a sort of traditional Japanese salaryman. He works for a huge Japanese company. He has sort of the traditional Japanese business job, but his family is quite open-minded. You know, they're not sort of overtly rebellious, but they're quite open-minded. His father's family is, his father sort of comes from a long line of academics, and in Japan, I guess, as well as in America, there's a sort of sense of open-mindedness among the academic community, I take it. His family, the only academics I know, but they have always been really welcoming to me. His friends, however, I barely have met. And that was another real shock for me about Japan, is that men and women, couples, socialize separately. And even if you're married, you don't necessarily spend time or even meet your partner's friends, which took a lot of adjusting for me. And yet I see some wisdom in, which I wouldn't have expected.
Tracy Slater is my guest. She's founder of the global literary series Four Stories and author of the new memoir, The Good Shufu, Finding Love, Self, and Home on the Far Side of the World. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Tracy Slater about her new memoir, The Good Shufu, Finding Love, Self, and Home on the Far Side of the World. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Tracy, I should ask you, what is a good shufu? What is a shufu?
Shufu means a housewife in Japanese, but it's a bit of more of a neutral term in Japan than it is here. I think in among many people in America, the term housewife holds somewhat of a negative connotation. And in Japan, it's a very common term that women use to describe themselves, partly because even very well-educated women in Japan tend to quit their jobs when they get married, even if they don't have children.
How did you start thinking you might like to have a child? And what was it when that first those feelings first emerged that worried you?
I first realized that I wanted to have a child when I looked at pictures of Toru as a baby, and his father had them in the living room. And one night I was sort of just innocently flipping through old family photos after I had, you know, cooked dinner for Toru and his father and served them tea. And I just saw this picture of Toru and I thought he was the most beautiful baby. And I had this, you know, truthfully, it wasn't even an intellectual thing. It was I had this like visceral desire to grab the baby, and I even felt like I wanted to kind of bite the baby. He was so cute. And so I don't know, I just had this reaction, and I never thought I wanted children, and I certainly never thought I could handle a child living in Japan and being, you know, married to a man from such a different culture and being so far away from home. But I realized that I did want to have a child. And as we went further along in the process, I was 40 by the time I realized it. And, well, I was 39 but when I first saw the picture, and I was probably close to 41. I was in my, I was past my 40th birthday when I stopped being neurotic enough about it to even give it a try. So,
which is not the ideal, which is not the ideal time in a woman's life to really seriously begin trying to conceive.
No, not at all. And you know, we tried for just a couple of months, and I went to the women's clinic in Japan, which was itself quite a culture shock, and just to have a checkup, and they said to me, you need to start IVF right away. There's your chances of conceiving even with IVF are very low. And so, you know, I mean, we thought we would try for a couple of months and then give up if it didn't work. And the further along we went into the process, the more deeply attached I became to the sense that our baby was out there, and that I didn't know that we were going to get to meet our baby, but I just had this sense, once again, sort of like marrying Toru, that I had to try. I had no idea how it was going to work out, but that it would be a deeply wounding regret did I not give it everything I had to try.
There's this moment I really felt for you where you said to your stepmother, you were caring at that point for your father-in-law, who was elderly and ailing by this point, and you said basically, not only did I never expect to be changing diapers at this moment, but I didn't think it would be for an old man and not for a baby.
Yeah, I mean, we went through years of trying to have a baby and pregnancy losses in Japan, and then we basically, my doctors in Japan said, and they weren't being medically irresponsible, they said, you know, I turned 45, and they said, you basically have 0% chance statistically of having a child, getting pregnant and carrying a healthy pregnancy to term. And right as we were going through that transition, Toru's father, with whom I was very close, I absolutely adored him. We lived right near him, and taking care of him was, I mean, he really took care of me when I first got to Japan. He really, really helped me. But as he really declined, taking care of him became a big part of our lives and a really important part of my life in a way I would have never expected. And it was, and yet it was a very mixed experience, not only because it's painful to see someone that you love decline, but because there was a way in which it sort of filled some need, I think, for me that I had this sort of really intimate physical connection with someone who was dependent on me, you know, as I turned 45 and thought, you know what, our baby maybe should have been out there, but is obviously not out there, and we're not going to get to meet our baby. And there was a way in which I was taking care of Tora's father, and it was very meaningful to me in a way that I felt very complex about, and some ways guilty and in some ways thankful for.
Do people in Japan talk about infertility in a different way? Do they talk about it more or less than in this country? You know, some couples will be right up front and some don't want anybody to know they're trying and not succeeding.
I mean, Japan tends to be a much more reserved culture than America. So people, you know, I feel like it wouldn't be that beyond the pale to be sort of standing in line at Starbucks in America and, you know, you see someone from whom you know from the fertility clinic or something, and you might sort of trade, you know, advice or just chat about it or something. And that just does not happen in Japan. I mean, you don't talk to people in line at Starbucks anyway. I mean, there actually are a lot of Starbucks there, but you just don't talk to the people in line that you don't know. So, yeah, there's definitely a sense of a much more sense of reserve among strangers. And they also, their medical community is a lot more conservative in terms of things such as donor eggs are not allowed. They're not illegal, but they're not approved by the Japanese Obstetric Society, I think is the actual term. So you can't do a donor egg in Japan. You can't do a surrogacy in Japan. So, and you can't also, as you get older, it's very hard to convince a doctor to implant more than one, maybe two eggs, two embryos in you. There's quite a feeling that multiple pregnancies is a real risk, and it's a risk that doctors aren't willing to take in Japan, whereas American doctors, I think, live a little bit more on the edge with that.
So you had given up on this idea, or maybe not quite given up, but you were in the process of coming to terms with it.
Yes, I was mourning it. That's, you're exactly right. I hadn't given up. Well, Toru hadn't given up. And he said, you know, even though we're not medically going to do anything anymore, we should still keep trying. And I agreed to that. But I really, in my heart, thought, there's no way I'm going to get pregnant at 40, past my 45th birthday, and have a healthy pregnancy and give birth to a child. And so we were still trying, but we had, but I, at the same time, I was mourning the possibility that we were ever going to get to meet our baby, which is what it felt like to me.
And at the risk of spoiling things for people, I think
totally
people
fine.
People know where this is leading.
Yes,
you
yes.
had this like miraculous pregnancy at a moment where it seemed impossible.
Yes, I did. I got pregnant naturally at 45 and a half and gave birth to a healthy baby girl at 46 and 4 months past my 46th birthday. I actually don't, I'm still pregnant at the end of the book, but we have found out that the baby is healthy and that for, you know, for all intents and purposes, we can expect to have a healthy baby being born soon. And it was a decision whether or not to end when I was still pregnant. Or, I mean, initially I got the book proposal. I got the book contract to write a book where I would turn 45 and be in a, quote, barren and yet still very meaningful marriage. And I was almost finished with the manuscript and I became pregnant. And I didn't even tell my editor right away because I thought there's no way that this that I'm going to carry this pregnancy to term.
Yeah.
And finally, when we realized I would, I contacted her and said, well, I think I should just end the story when I turned 45, because at 45 I was not pregnant and not expecting to get pregnant. And she said, no. She said, you're not going to show up to readings with a half Japanese baby and, you know, where the book ends and you're, you know, and it seems like the last note is an infertility note. But I didn't want to end the book. The book is not about infertility,
right.
But the last chapter to there, you know, that's what I'm going through. And I just didn't want to write a book where there was a part of it that was about infertility, and then at the end sort of have it end with this sort of miraculous birth. It just felt, I don't know, I guess I'm just not that optimistic. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't want to write a book where everything, I just feel like life doesn't tie up perfectly. And I didn't want to write a memoir that gave the impression of a sort of narrative arc where everything ties up personally. It just went against my sense of the world and also my sense of aesthetics.
Is that just because so many people don't have that happy ending?
Yeah. Yeah. And also because I feel like life isn't perfect and life requires big sacrifices. And one thing that I have learned and I'm still learning in my marriage and in this life that's so different from anything I ever expected is, you know, to sort of face those truths with some sense of equanimity and also honesty. And I just felt it would be sort of dishonest or not honoring the kind of gray part of life and the complexity of life to write a memoir where everything just ends on a sort of perfectly happy note.
The fact that you have your little girl, though, and she is a person in your life raises so many questions for me that are interesting to me, which is after you've struggled with your own identity and who you are as this American woman living in Japan, living a kind of Japanese life, but with an American sense of yourself, what do you think now about raising a daughter who will probably, for all intents and purposes, think of herself as a Japanese woman with an American mom?
Oh, it's so similar in some ways to my experience of falling in love with Toru and marrying him. And just, you know, I would wake up every morning, you know, that when I was in Japan and think, in some ways, I feel so who I am and who I'm supposed to be. And in other ways, I think, who am I? And I feel like that's life. That's coming to terms. That's what life is, coming to terms with the fact that in some ways you're just so rooted in who you're supposed to be if you're really fortunate to reach that place. And yet you still feel totally lost in some ways. And I feel, you know, so, I'm so, you know, head over heels madly in love with our baby. And I feel so right being a mother and being our baby's mother. And yet I wake up in the morning still and I think, God, this is so who I'm supposed to be and who am I?
Yeah.
So it's sort of similar.
Have you, I mean, I guess you now speak Japanese. I don't know if you read Japanese, if you pick up like Japanese parenting magazines, and if are there big differences?
Oh God, no, I don't. No, I don't. I don't. Actually, this is something I really, really want to learn about, and is something that I'm toying around with writing a little bit more about, and goes back to your earlier question, which the part of it that I didn't answer yet, which is, you know, having a child who's sort of part and parcel of Japanese culture. And I do want to learn a lot more about Japanese parenting. I do not read Japanese well enough at all to be able to read. I mean, it takes me like 5 minutes to you know, sound out a two-word sign. But I am really interested in the way in which, you know, I'm now sort of in this one more sort of dichotomy of a situation where there's this child who I'm so intimately connected to, and she's my flesh and blood, and yet she belongs to a culture and is will always be inextricably tied to a culture where I will always and forever be seen as a foreigner.
Hmm.
So, but to really get my hands around that, I do need to learn a little bit more about Japanese parenting.
Is it an advantage for you that you look like a foreigner, that people, you know, don't necessarily expect you to open your mouth and speak perfect Japanese?
I think it's such an advantage in some ways to look like a foreigner. And also there are real advantages, not just within my relationship, but honestly to being an expat in Japan, not being able to speak Japanese perfectly. I mean, Japan is, as I said earlier, a real sort of black and white culture. The sense of boundaries is so crucial to almost everything about that culture, I think. And one of those boundaries is who's Japanese and who isn't. And you're very, very clearly told on many different levels, if you're a foreigner in Japan, that you are a foreigner and you will never be part of Japanese society, even if you're married into a Japanese family. And I think that there's a way in which if there's something about you that kind of confounds that boundary, like you're fluent in Japanese or, you know, you're dressed in sort of traditional Japanese garb or something, I think there's a way in which that sort of kind of goes against what people expect. So I feel not just looking like a foreigner, but also being someone who I'm very comfortable with the idea that I'm not Japanese and never will be. I don't want to be. I'm American. And I think there's a lot of ways in which that works in my favor. I wouldn't have thought that initially, but I found that that's true.
Tracy Slater is founder of the global literary series Four Stories, and she's author of the new memoir, The Good Shufu, Finding Love, Self, and Home on the Far Side of the World. Tracy, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been really nice to be with you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.